Welcome to this special CME program on diagnosis and management of tumor lysis syndrome, or TLS, and clinical oncology. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. William Weirda from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
The first case is a 28-year-old with a newly diagnosed Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL. And this patient has an elevated white count, as we expect to see in a newly diagnosed patient, a white blood cell count of 80,000, and most of those will be blasts. They're anemic and thrombocytopenic by virtue of their disease. We often see cases where patients have spontaneous tumor lysis syndrome that's ongoing when they're newly diagnosed because the disease is so proliferative. So in this case, the uric acid is elevated at 10.2, LDH is elevated at 2274. The creatinine is 1, which is within the normal range. Potassium is on the higher side of normal at 4.8, phosphorus is elevated at 5.3, and the calcium is 8.3. So this patient is getting his diagnosis and is about to start treatment with induction chemotherapy with hypercevad and dasatinib, which is our standard first-line therapy, which is a standard first-line therapy for Philadelphia chromosome positive ALL.
Could you go through these various numbers that you just discussed and discuss them within the context of TLS and clinically how you make the diagnosis of TLS and its severity?
Right. So the first probably issue is the diagnosis. So various diagnoses carry various risks for TLS. When we're talking about the high-risk diseases for tumor lysis syndrome, those would include things like ALL, T-cell ALL, B-cell ALL, patients with Burkitt's lymphoma, the diseases that are very proliferative and are likely to respond rapidly to treatment. So any case of newly diagnosed ALL, we are concerned and thinking about TLS. Other factors that we look at are the LDH. So this patient's LDH is high. And in our guidelines at Anderson, they are considered high risk if they have an elevated white blood cell count over 100,000, or if it's less than 100,000, if their LDH is twice the upper limit of normal. And in this case, at 2,274, they are twice the upper limit of normal. They have a white count of 80,000. So this patient would be considered as having high risk for tumor lysis. Before we start treatment, we assess their electrolytes and evaluate uric acid because we do have interventions for uric acid as well as for the electrolyte abnormalities. So one of the first things we look at is the uric acid, and in this case, his uric acid is elevated. And because of his high risk for tumor lysis and because he has an elevated uric acid over 7, we would consider this patient an appropriate candidate for resbiracase. And that should be started before or at least at the time the induction chemotherapy is started, but optimally at least 4 hours before the patient starts their chemotherapy.
What kind of numbers would the patient have to actually, as you say, be in tumor lysis, you know, without even therapy?
So there's different criteria for that. It depends on if you look at the Cairo-Bishop criteria or if you look at the Howard criteria.
But globally, what are the key factors that would make you say this patient has TLS?
The elevated uric acid, the elevated phosphorus, for me in this particular case, are two indicators that there is some low level of ongoing spontaneous TLS and that this patient, given the high white count, is at very high risk or is at high risk for tumor lysis when we initiate therapy.
What would the numbers have to be for you to say this patient's in tumor lysis and is clinically significant?
Again, that depends on if you look at the Cairo-Bishop criteria or the Howard criteria. I would have to refer to those specific numbers. I don't recall the numbers off the top of my head.
Well, I'm thinking more from a clinical point of view and your own sort of general clinic. What would it take for, first of all, I'm just kind of curious, are all these patients seen by nephrologists?
We typically will consult the nephrologist if they have spontaneous tumor lysis or if their electrolytes are becoming abnormal as they initiate their therapy.
I'm curious what you would do specifically in this high-risk situation, and would it be any different, again, if the numbers were worse?
If the numbers were worse, in this particular case, what I would do is this patient needs to be hospitalized for electrolyte management and induction chemotherapy. This patient needs aggressive IV hydration so as to prevent kidney damage and kidney failure. Because of the elevated uric acid and the high risk for tumor lysis, we need to use an agent like resbiricase to get the uric acid down. And also, we would probably initiate allopurinol in this patient as an additional measure. The potassium in this case looks to be not at a dangerous level and not at a level that I would necessarily do any intervention right now. I would monitor the potassium very closely, though. The phosphorus being elevated at 5.2, we would probably put this patient also on a phosphate binding agent. And this patient, as they initiate their therapy, should be monitored every 8 to 12 hours for electrolyte abnormalities and appropriate interventions as time goes on to manage any electrolyte abnormalities.
You talked about using both resbiricase and allopurinol. Can you kind of take a step back and talk more globally about the way you utilize these two agents and other treatment approaches for hyperuricemia?
So for hyperuricemia, for low-risk patients, we can usually manage those patients with allopurinol. We don't need to give them typically resbiricase. So they can typically be managed by allopurinol. In a patient who has an aggressive leukemia or lymphoma, I will usually give them two or three doses, higher doses for the first two or three doses, and then put them on the regular dose of 300 milligrams daily if they have a normal creatinine. But I'll give them 600 for 1 or 2 days initially to manage them. And it isn't until patients are at high risk for tumor lysis or they have spontaneous ongoing tumor lysis and an elevated uric acid that we would consider them appropriate for resbiricase. And we would use resbiricase in those situations. I think it's debatable whether or not you need to give both resbiricase and allopurinol. Resbiricase probably is sufficient to get them through the initial period of tumor lysis. So it's not essential that you use allopurinol if you've considered or have initiated treatment with resbiricase.
When you do utilize resbiricase, how exactly do you go about using it? Is it usually just one dose?
So the studies are weight-based dosing, which is probably more resbiricase than one would need. So we have guidelines at our institution that we follow. We don't follow weight-based dosing currently at our institution. It's a flat dose. We give a flat dose of 3 milligrams or 6 milligrams. Depending on how high the uric acid is. And we give one dose and then monitor, and we'll redose if the uric acid rises again. So it's not multiple doses automatically. It's one dose and then monitoring and redosing. And it's usually the first dose is 3 milligram flat dose.
Any tolerability toxicity issues at all with resbiricase?
So with resbiricase, it's contraindicated in patients with G6PD deficiency. So that's the main concern. Will you typically check patients for G6PD deficiency? And that's been, in my experience, really the only issue. The blood needs to be drawn. There's a special drawing for patients who have gotten resbiricase to measure uric acid levels. So that is an additional component.
And what would you expect would be a typical trajectory for this patient as you treat the patient, particularly as it relates to the question of TLS? What would you expect to be typically happening, and what might you see if things sort of go in the wrong direction?
Mm-hmm. So the clinical course, once we initiate therapy, depends a lot on the bulk of disease. He has an elevated white blood cell count of 80,000, but it also, his clinical course will also be dependent on if he's got big bulky nodes, if he's got splenomegaly. So the bulk of disease correlates with the clinical course in terms of tumor lysis. So what I would hope to see in a case like this would be we would give a dose of resbiricase. We would be aggressively hydrating the patient. The patient would be put on their chemotherapy and we'll initiate the chemotherapy. We would check electrolytes every 8 to 12 hours. If the potassium rises, then we will give a potassium binding agent. And that's typically if the potassium is over 5. And in those cases, we will have a nephrologist also closely monitoring the patient and assessing for the need for dialysis. other interventions other than managing potassium with potassium binding agents. If they're very high potassium, then we have given insulin before and glucose as a temporizing measure. And obviously, hemodialysis is an option in those patients who have very high potassium level.
Could I just ask, I'm curious, have you seen patients with clinical sequela of hyperkalemia utilizing all these measures? And what do you see? What is the greatest concern? Is it arrhythmias?
It's arrhythmias. Yes, we have seen patients with high potassiums and have peak T waves. And in those patients, we are typically, if there's any evidence of arrhythmia, those are patients we're considering hemodialysis for acute management of their hyperkalemia.
What about actual renal failure? Do you see that?
We have seen renal failure in patients who have severe cases of tumor lysis, yes.
And what's the mechanism?
So the mechanism, there are several mechanisms. There's crystal deposits in the kidney, which cause a nephropathy. And there are vascular changes that occur also with cytokine release and various aspects of what's happening to patients when their leukemia cells or lymphoma cells are dying rapidly.
Is permanent long-term renal failure seen in this situation? Is it ever seen?
Usually it's reversible renal failure. We have seen rarely cases of irreversible renal failure, but typically it's reversible.
Any other serious major complications of TLS that you've observed over the years and things you want to comment on?
Not that I can think of. It's usually issues that occur in the acute setting. It's typically related to electrolyte abnormalities and electrolyte derangements and potential need for hemodialysis.
So I see your second case is CLL, and that's, I'm really glad to hear that because I've been curious about that, not just about venetoclax, but the whole issue of tumor lysis with CLL. So why don't we go through this one?
So the second case is a 60-year-old patient with previously untreated chronic lymphocytic leukemia, has trisomy 12 and a mutated V gene, RISE stage 3 disease, palpable lymph nodes at 3 to 4 centimeters, has a white blood cell count of 120,000, is mildly anemic at 10.5, and has a platelet count of 115. This patient has a uric acid level of 5.2, an LDH of 352, serum creatinine is normal at 1, creatinine clearance is 82, and potassium is normal at 4.1, phosphorus is normal at 4.2, and calcium is normal at 9.3. So this patient is going on initial treatment. The initial treatment in this case is with chemoimmunotherapy, which has historically been the standard of care. Standard of care is changing, but at the time this patient received fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab as his initial therapy. Given the high white blood cell count and measurable lymph nodes, there is some level of risk, although it's low, of tumor lysis syndrome. So in these cases, we will typically give patients prophylactic treatment with allopurinol before we start the chemotherapy, and we will encourage them to have adequate oral fluid intake, and we'll monitor their electrolytes. Occasionally, I'll have a patient come back into the clinic on the second day of therapy to check their electrolytes to make sure they're not having issues with tumor lysis. But there is a low risk for tumor lysis in such cases, cases of CLL, who have a significant amount of disease, who are going on chemoimmunotherapy. And typically, we manage those patients with oral hydration and with prophylactic allopurinol.
And what specifically do you do about repeat blood work?
So if I'm concerned about tumor lysis, I will, so fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab is a three-day regimen. So I have checked patients' electrolyte values on the second day of treatment if I'm concerned about tumor lysis syndrome. In this case, I probably would not necessarily recheck the electrolytes. But if I were concerned or if there was any evidence of spontaneous tumor lysis before the patient started treatment, then certainly I would recheck their electrolytes on day 2 and perhaps day 3 of treatment.
We had a few cases that really last year that sort of sparked my interest that were presented at a conference we did. One was a patient who actually got tumor lysis syndrome and actually had temporary dialysis, not that much different from this, other than the fact the patient was older, I think about 75. I think the white count was higher. And as I said, actually it was Jonathan Friedberg's case, believe it or not. He presented it to me on a program we did. And then we had another case where a doc in the community had a very similar patient. previously healthy 65-year-old woman, and the doc used aggressive IV hydration, and the patient went into heart failure. Was very upset about it, too, and then she was fine. What about as the white count gets higher, the bulk of tumor gets higher? I mean, is this a realistic concern? Are there situations? What would get you to use IV hydration, for example?
I think you bring up an important point, and that is the creatinine and the creatinine clearance, which is a critical feature that we need to pay close attention to in any patient who is at risk for tumor lysis or who is initiating treatment. So if they have renal impairment, then their risk for tumor lysis is going to be higher, and that applies to both patients with low-risk TLS disease or obviously patients with high-risk disease. So, and there is a correlation between creatinine and creatinine clearance and age. So the older we get, the less renal function we have. And so in patients who are older, this patient is 60. In a patient who's 70 or older, then I more closely monitor those patients and will consider IV hydration in those cases where the creatinine clearance is low and I'm worried about tumor lysis syndrome.
Have you seen cases, you know, like I just described, where patients actually ended up having tumor lysis syndrome from chemoimmunotherapy up front?
Yes, for sure. And again, it correlates with the bulk of disease, and it also strongly correlates with the kidney function, the renal function, and whether or not they're able to handle the electrolyte changes that occur when the tumor cells are dying.
As long as we're mentioning that, before we get onto the other issue with CLL and your other case scenario, again, in terms of this initial issue with CLL, in terms of how you approach it, can you kind of describe a situation? You mentioned the issue of renal impairment. What about the issue of patients who are getting, for example, bendamustine rituximab, still a common upfront regimen, in terms of, I see all kinds of differences, and I'm not sure if this is just related to infusion reaction or in some way related to potential TLS, holding the rituximab, delaying the rituximab. Any comments about that whole issue?
Sure. So I would separate tumor lysis syndrome and risk for tumor lysis syndrome from infusion-related reactions that we see with the monoclonal antibodies. So rituximab, obinutuzumab, ofatumumab, all of the CD20 antibodies will give infusion-related reactions. Those usually manifest as fever, chills, hypotension. You can see hypertension. You don't necessarily see electrolyte abnormalities. You don't typically see renal failure in those situations. And we will usually pre-medicate to reduce the risk for those infusion-related reactions. We use steroids for the various CD20 antibodies as pre-medication. For example, for obinutuzumab, the first dose is split. So you give 100 milligrams on day one and then 900 milligrams on day two for their first dose of obinutuzumab in order to reduce the risk for those infusion-related reactions that you see with that CD20 antibody in CLL.
What are you accomplishing by separating it from the chemo, for example, the bendamustine?
So typically, it's a logistic issue. With the first dose, patients will typically have infusion-related reactions. It takes longer to get that first dose in, so rather than being able to get it in 4 hours, or with rituximab, on subsequent doses for rituximab, we can get it in 90 minutes. On the first day for the first cycle, usually there are infusion-related reactions with those CD20 antibodies that delay the infusion. And so logistically, it makes more sense to give the chemotherapy starting on the second day of treatment. So most of our frontline regimens where we're giving a CD20 antibody, we'll give the CD20 antibody on day one first, and then the chemo comes in on day two.
Interesting. So before we get into the other issue in CLL, venetoclax, just want to pause for a second and also ask you about TLS out in other cancers and a couple of things specifically, solid tumors, is it ever seen? I heard it actually discussed, Bob Orlowski, you know, the myeloma people have talked about it with the drug carfilzomib in myeloma. Do you see it outside of the cancers we're talking about today?
Well, it's most common in the hematologic malignancies. The germ cell tumors, I believe they have a risk for tumor lysis in terms of solid tumors. Others, I think there's a much lower risk, like breast cancer, colon cancer. Typically, the solid tumors don't have a high risk for tumor lysis. It's the diseases that are highly proliferative and that there's a large bulk of disease when patients are going on treatment where the risk is high.
So let's talk about venetoclax and specifically the issue of TLS.
Venetoclax is a unique drug. It's different than any of the other oral drugs that we have. When we did the phase one clinical trial with venetoclax, we were doing a dose escalation, but there were patients who had grade 5 tumor lysis associated events in the trial where patients either stepped up on their dose or initiated at too high of a dose and fatal tumor lysis events were seen. So unlike most other drugs, venetoclax, because it's a very, very potent inducer of apoptosis in CLL cells, venetoclax, we have to initiate at a low dose of 20 milligrams a day and gradually escalate over a period of 4 to 5 weeks to get up to the target dose of 400 milligrams daily in order to avoid or minimize the risk of tumor lysis. We don't do that with any other medications for chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I can't think of other medicines that we do that for because of this risk. So it's a unique agent in that respect. The drug is started through a starter pack, which is the first month's supply, which has packets for each week for the patients, and it's very clear which packet to start with and which ones to go through in order to make sure patients go through an ordered escalation of their drug. It also has instructions in it in terms of how much hydrations patients should be getting and what their follow-up should be with their physician.
Could I just ask, just sort of intuitively, I've always found it sort of, a little bit strange about this whole thing with TLS and venetoclax. Do you think that it purely is the fact that it's just so quick and effective, or maybe something beyond that sort of biologically, pharmacologically?
No, I believe it's actually an on-target effect, and the CLL cells have high levels of BCL2. Venetoclax is an inhibitor of BCL2. BCL2 is an anti-apoptotic protein. You block the function of that anti-apoptotic protein, and it throws the cells into apoptosis, and there's rapid induction of cell death. So I think it's an on-target drug-specific effect.
And actually, I've heard from, I think, on-target drug-specific, but maybe also to some extent cancer-specific, because now we're hearing about it in mantle cell and also in myeloma, amazingly. And apparently, you don't see it. Is that right? You don't see TLS with venetoclax there?
Correct. As far as I know, we've been doing work in the leukemia department at Anderson in AML and myelodysplastic syndrome. So we're looking at it in those diseases. You don't have to go through the same orderly, protracted dose escalation in those other hematologic malignancies. There's activity. We also will use a higher dose in those diseases as our target dose.
So I want to get a little bit more into the mechanics of what's involved with venetoclax, but also just to take a second, we're not going to go through, all the data with venetoclax, but just hearing you talk about the issue of why it's, you see it with CLL, where do you think venetoclax is going to land? Do you think, I know it's being looked at in combination, maybe combination with ibrutinib. What are some of the strategies that include venetoclax, particularly in CLL, that you think might be most promising?
Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very potent drug in CLL. We have to use caution with it because of this risk for tumor lysis syndrome, but it's a highly effective drug at clearing disease from the blood and clearing disease from the bone marrow. I think that it's at least as potent, if not more potent, than chemotherapy, so we can achieve at least what we can, if not better, with venetoclax than we can with chemotherapy. So I would look for it to be used in combinations, and I think it's going to be a useful drug at allowing us to get rid of chemotherapy and achieve the same, if not better, therapeutic effects than we can in combination. So we're doing a clinical trial with ibrutinib plus venetoclax. There are large randomized trials with venetoclax plus CD20 antibody, and I think those studies will be positive. So it's a very potent drug. It's a very effective drug. It's a drug that's able to achieve minimal residual disease-free remissions, even in patients who have very high-risk features, like patients who have relapsed CLL with 17p deletion. And we haven't appreciated that degree of debulking and effectiveness with other oral agents like ibrutinib in the high-risk groups of patients.
I think also in contrast to ibrutinib, although certainly ibrutinib is well tolerated, but I don't know of any issues you can tell me in terms of tolerability or toxicity with venetoclax other than TLS? Is there anything?
So the TLS is the main risk. We do see neutropenia, drug-induced neutropenia, and so we monitor for neutropenia, and sometimes we need to dose adjust for patients who have neutropenia. And patients can have some low-grade GI intolerance, diarrhea, that type of thing. But for the most part, once patients get up to their 400 milligram daily dose, it's an extremely well-tolerated drug. And the most common reason for needing to adjust the dose is the neutropenia that can be seen.
And also, just to clarify, I mean, currently it's only indicated in DEL17P, but like ibrutinib, is it sort of equally effective in other patients?
So it is effective in other patients. It's approved in relapsed patients with deletion 17P. It is on the NCCN guidelines in combination with rituximab for relapsed disease. So there is trial data that supports its use in other areas. And like I said, there are ongoing phase 3 clinical trials where I expect those trials will be positive and will see a label in other areas, perhaps frontline treatment for CLL and relapsed disease.
I'm going to guess there's no head-to-head first-line trial with ibrutinib versus venetoclax?
No.
Would you like to see one?
I think the talents of the drugs are different. I think venetoclax, like I said, is very, very potent at reducing the bulk of disease. And I think venetoclax, if we're going to have a discussion about having a treatment-free interval, venetoclax is a drug that may allow us to do that. Ibrutinib is a very effective drug at controlling the disease. It doesn't get patients into good deep remissions. So they don't. It's very, very effective at clearing lymph nodes and reducing the size of lymph nodes. Ibrutinib is. And so that's a talent that that drug has that probably is less so with venetoclax. Venetoclax is highly potent at clearing blood and bone marrow. So in terms of the location of activity, I think they're complementary drugs. And I think what we need to conceptualize is using them together in order to get patients in good deep remissions so that we can talk about getting them in a treatment-free period, in a deep remission, and allow them to be off treatment for extended periods of time.
You mentioned your trial looking at ibrutinib combined with venetoclax. What about sequentially? Is there any interest in that?
I am not aware of any trials that are doing that. The trial that we have in the pharmaceutical-sponsored studies are 3 months first of ibrutinib, and then we add the venetoclax, and that's to allow for some debulking of the disease before we start the venetoclax, and in hopes of reducing the risk for tumor lysis on initiation of venetoclax. But I'm not aware of any trials where patients are getting a period of monotherapy of ibrutinib, for example, followed by venetoclax.
That's fascinating. How many people have you treated so far?
We've treated about 25, I believe.
Wow. Any tolerability issues?
Nope. It's a well-tolerated regimen, and we're encouraged with the early activity.
That is really fascinating. Well, why don't we talk about this scenario, and we can kind of get further into it, this 70-year-old patient.
Okay. So the next patient's a 70-year-old, previously treated patient with 17p deletion, unmutated V gene, RAI stage 3 disease, who has progressive disease and needs a salvage therapy. The white count for this patient is 45,000. They're mildly anemic with a hemoglobin of 9.7. Platelet count's 105. Uric acid is 5.7, LDH is 839, serum creatinine is 1.2, and their creatinine clearance is 73, potassium 4.3, phosphorus 4.5, and calcium is 8.3. So this patient is appropriate for salvage therapy. They're appropriate for venetoclax therapy, and that was the therapy we were considering for this patient. When considering treatment with venetoclax, it's important to have a measure of the adenopathy prior to starting treatment because that's how we stratify patients for risk. So these patients, while we don't routinely do CAT scans pre-treatment for standard of care, if you are considering venetoclax, standard of care would be to do a pre-treatment CAT scan to measure the adenopathy. So this patient had a CAT scan and their largest lymph node was 6 centimeters and they were initiating on venetoclax therapy.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of globally or even specifically how the size of the nodes and also the white count contribute to identifying what the risk classification is for the patient?
Right. So the risk stratification is, it requires a little bit of work because you need to review the white blood cell count and you need to review the CAT scan measurements. And patients are categorized into one of three different categories for their risk for tumor lysis. There's low risk, there's intermediate risk, and there's high risk, and their risk stratification is based on white count and lymph nodes. If they have a white blood cell count of less than 25 and their largest node is less than 5 centimeters, they're in the low risk category. If they have a lymph node that is greater than 5 centimeters but less than 10 centimeters, or their white count is above 25,000, then they're in the medium risk category. They're high risk if they have any nodes that are greater than 10 centimeters, or if they have a white blood cell count that's greater than 25,000 and nodes that are greater than 5 centimeters, but less than 10 centimeters.
So this patient has the white count and then the combination with the 6 centimeters.
Yes, so this patient is a high risk. This patient is high risk for tumor lysis by virtue of the white count and the lymph node measurement. And I would also be closely monitoring this patient because their creatinine clearance is 73.
I was going to bring that up because of your previous comment when you were talking about renal function. And first of all, I thought it was really cool that the package insert had that algorithm. It was so useful. I don't remember ever seeing anything like it. But, I mean, obviously it wasn't saying you can't consider other things, but you would think that age and renal function really would affect the way you approach this.
For sure it does. And so in their algorithm, particularly if a patient has a creatinine clearance of less than 80 mils per minute and they're medium risk, one should consider managing them as a high risk. It's in the package insert. Most of the patients with CLL, as you know, are over 70, and most of them don't have normal creatinine clearance. So you have to pay close attention not only to the white count and the nodes, but also their creatinine clearance.
Do you typically get a creatinine clearance in patients with CLL getting upfront treatment, particularly your older patients?
Well, it's a calculated creatinine clearance, so we'll calculate their creatinine clearance. We won't do a 24-hour urine collection.
Right. So this patient then, I guess, would fit into the high-risk category.
Yes. So this patient would fit into the high-risk category, and we would follow the algorithm for high-risk. For high-risk patients, they get admitted for their first dose, and they get admitted for their first dose escalation. And during their admission, they receive IV hydration, and they receive allopurinol. They receive resbiricase if they have an elevated uric acid, and they're monitored with serial labs during the first 24 hours of their dosing.
So for a patient, which I would guess is the average patient who everything goes smoothly with, how long are they actually in the hospital?
They're in the hospital for a little bit longer than 24 hours. So they get admitted before their dosing, they get a lab, and then they get serial labs after that, and then they get a day 2 pre-dose lab, and then they, if their labs are okay on day 2 of dosing, pre, they dose, and then they can be released from the hospital. So it's a little bit more than 24 hours.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting now that I think about it, I kind of accepted this algorithm, but I don't know, you would think for a healthy patient, particularly like this one, that somehow this could be pulled off as an outpatient. I mean, what do they need to monitor? It's just the blood work.
It's the blood work, but it's blood work that needs to be done serially. So patients get blood electrolytes checked at 4 hours post-dose, 8 hours post-dose, 12 hours post-dose, and then they get their 24-hour post-dose. You can't really do that as an outpatient.
I don't know. Maybe visiting nurses to draw the blood. I don't know. You know, all the quality cost issues. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyhow. Well, I guess for now, it'd be safer, I guess, to follow the algorithm. Can you talk about the medium risk patient?
So the medium risk patients can be managed as outpatients, and those patients require a bit more hydration. So those patients, for sure, they need to do oral hydration, and oftentimes I will give them some IV hydration prior to their dosing. So I tell patients low risk or medium risk, they need to drink 2 liters a day of water every day. Some people would say, okay, they only need to drink at least 2 liters of water the day before and the day of the initiation or escalation, but I'll usually tell them to drink it through the week. For the medium risk, those patients, again, can be monitored as outpatient, and I would consider and usually give IV hydration pre-dose for those patients, at least for the first dose and the first dose escalation. They need a lab check post-dose, which can be done as an outpatient, and that's 6 to 8 hours post-dose, and then 24 hours post-dose. And then if their 24-hour post-dose lab is adequate and they're not having any issues with tumor lysis, then they can continue on their dosing. Interestingly, we don't need to monitor or evaluate the subsequent days. So it's just the first day and the second day that we're closely monitoring the electrolytes. And then once that's done, then patients will continue on their dosing if they're not having any problems to come back the next week.
So it's interesting about the 2 liters, because I saw that in that table and I was thinking to myself, of me drinking 2 liters. Do you have patients who have a hard time getting that in?
That I don't know. I mean, I tell them and they don't really complain that they're usually motivated. When they know the importance of drinking 2 liters, they're usually motivated to do it. Now, I don't know what happens when they get home and if they really are compliant with doing it. I hope so. But that has not been a difficult discussion with patients.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just 8 glasses of water or something. You know, it's interesting. The third case that we had, I told you about the dialysis case and the heart failure. The third case was the same exact case where the doc said, well, you know, I told him to drink excess fluids and patient was totally fine, just sort of cruised through like the average patient. So
right.
I guess we're talking about the exceptional situation.
And I think it's a different situation where you're giving them 2 liters of oral hydration versus 2 liters of IV saline.
Right.
You don't get the same salt load as you do with 2 liters of oral hydration.
I'm curious right now, if you have a patient in whom you feel it's indicated you'd like to use ibrutinib, but they have atrial fibrillation, they're on anticoagulation, I don't know, maybe another situation where you have a patient with a bleeding issue, would you be comfortable utilizing venetoclax in a patient like that up front?
As a frontline therapy or as the next treatment? I mean, I would be comfortable using it as a frontline therapy, yes. It's difficult to get it in that situation because it's not approved for those patients. And like I said, there are phase 3 ongoing trials. One of them is a large German CLL study group trial, CLL14, which is evaluating venetoclax plus obinutuzumab in the frontline setting.
Yeah, I mean, we like to kind of pose that as a question. Obviously, there's, you know, whether or not it can be actually obtained. I'm just kind of curious, too, how often do you see a patient who you want to give ibrutinib for the first time and you do have concerns? How often do you see people with pre-existing atrial fibrillation and anticoagulation and other clinical situations that gives you pause?
Yeah, so we do see that. It's not a real common issue. So occasionally we'll see patients who are on warfarin. We will switch those patients to an alternative oral anticoagulant in order to put them on ibrutinib. So that isn't necessarily a contraindication. And patients who have atrial fibrillation, that also for me is not necessarily a contraindication. So if a patient has AFib and they're controlled, then I won't necessarily exclude ibrutinib as a treatment option for those patients. I think the biggest challenge today in terms of patients getting these agents are patients who have Medicare, who have a huge copay and have difficulty affording their medication. That seems to be the biggest toxicity right now.
Wow, that's really interesting and not too surprising. What do you do with patients who develop atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib?
So patients who develop atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib will see a cardiologist. They will usually be put on an antiarrhythmic like amiodarone to try to convert them into sinus. We usually will hold their ibrutinib. And either they'll convert and will rechallenge with a lower dose of ibrutinib, or they will be maintained in atrial fibrillation but rate controlled. And then in those patients, we will also typically reinitiate ibrutinib therapy.
So I think I heard about some data that suggested that over the long term, a significant number of patients end up getting taken off ibrutinib for tolerability issues. Do you think that occurs, and what kinds of tolerability issues occur with ibrutinib that are significant problems, if any?
Right. So for sure it occurs. If you look at the frontline trials with ibrutinib, the patients who get frontline ibrutinib who come off the drug, the majority are not coming off, even the salvaged patients, are not coming off because the drug's not working any longer. They're coming off for some other reason, usually tolerability. So they come off for things like atrial fibrillation. The things that aren't discussed extensively but are probably more common are other things like arthralgias, myalgias, fatigue, rash, those types of things, GI intolerance. And it's not an insignificant number of patients who come off the drug come off for those reasons.
Yeah, any estimate? I mean, this one data set, I think they estimate like 50%, which really shocked me. What would you think, the over a 3-4 year period, for example?
So if you look at the ibrutinib trials for the previously treated patients, it's probably about 50% who come off over 5 years from the drug. And that's for the combination of reasons, toxicity as well as resistance to the drug. Fewer come off in the frontline setting. It's about a third over that period of time. And again, most of them come off because of intolerability issues rather than the drug not being effective at treating the disease.
Interesting. So you had another sort of part two to this case that I think is really interesting in terms of what happened in the second week.
Right. So part two of this is a scenario that we see commonly, and that is patients have infection. These patients are at high risk for infection because their immune system's not normal. So in this case, this patient developed a pneumonia and needed to be admitted to the hospital for IV antibiotics at the end of the second week of treatment. So the hospitalization related to an unrelated issue of pneumonia required the drug to be held. And I think an important topic to talk about is in patients who have an interruption in their dose, particularly if they're getting dose escalation, how do you manage those patients? What do you do? And so in this case, the patient had about a week delay or a week interruption in their venetoclax treatment to get treatment for their pneumonia during their hospitalization. And the appropriate approach in this case that we took was to reinitiate drug, but to restart the escalation. So the patient had finished the 50 milligram dose level, but the patient still had an elevated white blood cell count of 35,000 when we were reinitiating. We didn't rescan the patient, but in this case, with about a week interruption of treatment and a persistently elevated white blood cell count, I think the appropriate thing to do was to restart the escalation. So we went back to the 20 milligram dose and initiated at 20 milligrams and then went through again for a week for the 20 milligram dose and then up to 50 milligrams. If a patient's further along in their escalation, usually the bulk of disease is less. Usually the white count is normalized during the fourth and fifth week. And so the risk for TLS in those cases, in that situation, is, I think, lower. And in that situation, had this patient been in during week three, we would probably backed off and reinitiated at the last prior dose and then continue the escalation through that rather than starting all over again.
And I'm kind of curious, how low was the patient's white count? And do you think it was from the venetoclax?
So this patient's white count went down to 35,000.
No, I'm sorry. I meant the neutrophil count.
So we do see low. I don't remember off the top of my head what the neutrophil count in this case was, but even prior to treatment in patients who have an elevated white count, 30,000, 40,000, there is a dilutional effect, and it's not uncommon for us to see neutropenia. That's not the same as if you have neutropenia from chemotherapy per se, because these patients have, there's a dilutional effect, and they usually will be able to mount some response. So for example, if I have a patient with a white count of 35,000, they have CLL and they have an ANC of 200, I don't necessarily put those patients on neutropenic prophylaxis because their risk is not as high as if they are truly neutropenic from some other reason like chemotherapy.
Let's hear about your 72-year-old patient.
This case is a 72-year-old patient with previously treated CLL who was needing a salvage therapy. They had a white count of 30,000. And they had a largest lymph node size prior to treatment of 3 centimeters. This patient needed a salvage therapy, and the intent was to go on to venetoclax. The important issue for this case was to illustrate the need to evaluate the creatinine clearance, and to adjust management based on the creatinine clearance, particularly if it's less than 80 mils per minute. So this patient had a creatinine clearance of 50, and while they were technically a medium risk case, they were managed as a high risk for TLS case in the initiation and escalation of the venetoclax. That was the important point for this case.
And I'm curious, with these two patients that we've just talked about, how did they do?
Excellent. We've seen excellent responses. The overall response rate with venetoclax monotherapy is about 80%. We see significant number of complete remissions. And as I mentioned before, we're seeing minimal residual disease-free bone marrows in responding patients with venetoclax monotherapy. And the rate is even higher when you add a CD20 antibody. And we're seeing activity in patients who are developing resistance to ibrutinib. So I think this is a very effective alternative therapy to ibrutinib in patients who are developing ibrutinib resistance.
You mentioned the possibility of non-indefinite treatment or fixed duration treatment of venetoclax. What are some of the thoughts in terms of duration? Are you thinking about a fixed duration or based on MRD, or how do you think it would be approached?
So we've had a lot of discussion about that. There's a lot of work going on in our group at MD Anderson with regard to that. We've talked about both scenarios, fixed duration, as well as endpoint-based treatment like MRD-negative complete remission. I think probably what we'll see for the sake of simplicity is fixed duration, and we will generate data based on the fixed duration, and hopefully we'll be able to optimize that fixed duration with some data. We don't yet have any data available, but I think what you'll see initially is fixed duration clinical trials and then data that supports, like I said, optimizing the fixed duration.
And any guesses of what that duration might be?
In the frontline trials, it's about a year of venetoclax in combination. Our clinical trial with ibrutinib venetoclax, it allows for up to 2 years of combination treatment. But we're collecting data in terms of response at every three-month intervals. We're collecting data in terms of bone marrow evaluations for minimal residual disease. So I think our approach right now, it's empiric, and we're saying 2 years, but it will be data-driven once we get some data from the trials that we have.
Is there any discussion about fixed-duration ibrutinib, or people just accept the fact that that just can't happen?
I think people are resigned to the fact that that's probably not going to happen because there's too much disease at 1 year that's persistent. Now, we do see, as patients stay on ibrutinib, marked improvements in responses over years. So we have patients now 4 years on treatment with ibrutinib as their first treatment, and they hadn't achieved a complete remission for the first couple years. We're seeing complete responses, and we've seen a few minimal residual disease-free complete responses in patients who've been maintained on drug for 4 or more years. So the fixed duration for ibrutinib is going to be an extended period if we're talking about a fixed duration, because it's slower, patients have a slower time to best response with ibrutinib.
Although who knows what happens when you start using combinations. And, you know, thinking about your comment about the issue of cost, when people bring that up with some of these oral agents, one of the things I think about, and I think it's probably more relevant with venetoclax, is, I mean, if you end up taking it for a year, that obviously affects the cost.
Sure. Yep.
Anyhow, why don't we go on and finish out with your 62-year-old patient?
The last case is a 62-year-old, and this case was just to review and illustrate what we do for the low-risk patients. And this patient had a white count of 22,000, had a lymph node of measured by CAT scan of 4 centimeters, and had a creatinine clearance of 90. And so the point here was to discuss how we manage patients who are at low risk for tumor lysis initiating and escalating on venetoclax. We typically will use as our standard the allopurinol, which is continued throughout the escalation. And this patient and patients with low risk for TLS are encouraged to do the oral hydration, again, 2 liters a day. And we're monitoring their labs pre-dose for the first dose, and then 6 to 8 hours post-dose and 24 hours post-dose for the first dose, as well as the second dose. And then subsequent doses, we just check the pre-dosing electrolytes to make sure that they're okay, but we don't need to do serial labs beyond the 50 milligram dose escalation.
So the final thing I want to ask you about, more macro point of view of CLL, your colleague Haygop Kantarjian, I think, well, at least said to me, maybe other people have said it, that maybe CLL is going to become the new CML. And I'm curious where you think things are heading and might be in the next 3 to 5 years with CLL. Where do you think these oral agents are going to fit in, but also where CAR T is going to fit in?
So I think that's the statement that it will become like CML is probably accurate. I think we have more work to do. The drugs that we have are not quite as effective as the drugs that we have for CML in terms of these deep molecular remissions that are seen in CML in the majority of patients. In CLL, there is more work to do, but I think we have the tools that we need in order to develop treatments like CML where we're able to get very deep remissions in the majority of patients and also where we will be able to treat patients and have a discussion about having a treatment-free interval and a break from treatment. So, I mean, there's been a revolution of treatment over the past 3 to 5 years in CLL. We have new drugs that work by different mechanisms of action. I think the new drugs afford us the opportunity to eliminate or at least delay the need for chemotherapy and all the bad things that we see with chemotherapy until later on in the disease, and only in patients that we need to use the chemotherapy for. So I'm encouraged about that aspect. I'm encouraged as an immunologist about CAR-Ts and the mechanism of CAR T-cell therapy. I've been the PI for the CAR T-cell trials in adult ALL at MD Anderson. And so I have personal experience with those trials and treating those patients. And my impression has been that there's still a lot of work that we need to do with CAR-Ts in order to make them relevant in CLL. There's a lot of toxicity that we see with CAR-Ts. And the patient population, that it's a very different patient population, CLL compared with ALL. ALL patients have a life-threatening disease, particularly if they are relapsed. And so there's a higher tolerance for toxicity in that group and in developing treatments for that group. So while it's appropriate for us to work through the toxicity and demonstrate effectiveness with the CAR-Ts in ALL, I think we need to work towards minimizing the toxicities and making it a more tolerable treatment in order to make it relevant in CLL. Now, there are some cases of CLL where they do have a life-threatening disease. Patients who are refractory to ibrutinib, who've been exposed to chemoimmunotherapy, who have high-risk cytogenetic features, et cetera. So for that subgroup, but it is a small subgroup of patients, CAR-Ts will be the first group, I think, that will see a benefit for the CAR-Ts in CLL. But I think there's a lot of work we still need to do with the CAR-Ts to make them more tolerated and more relevant in CLL.
What is the efficacy of CAR-T in that situation that you described?
So the complete remission rate in previously treated patients is about 50%. So there's activity there. That was a trial that was reported by the UPenn group. So the UPenn group has done work in CLL. The University of Washington group has done CLL work with CAR-Ts in CLL. So there's definite responses. There are definitely complete responses. But again, there's cytokine release syndrome that occurs where a quarter to a third of the patients end up in the ICU. And then we have also this other issue of neurotoxicity, which we don't really understand and is not insignificant.
So yeah, my mind's on CAR-T because actually David Porter is coming in here and we're going to do a CAR-T program. And I'm kind of curious where things stand in terms of trying to mitigate CRS. And could you envision a time in the future where really it isn't a major problem?
I do envision a time in the future where it isn't a major problem. I think that will come from engineering the CARs and designing the CARs so that stimulation through the CAR doesn't result in this rapid expansion of very activated cells that spew out a whole bunch of cytokines. So I think we need to work towards developing mechanisms that allow for better control of the expansion of the T cells. But I'm very, very optimistic that we will work through that. It's a highly active, highly effective treatment. They're doing work at UPenn now in CLL with the CAR Ts in combination with ibrutinib. So I haven't seen a lot of that data yet, but there are reports that there are very encouraging results with that combination of ibrutinib and the CAR Ts in CLL.
You mentioned the neurologic problems that have been seen. Is it your vision that this is sort of part of the CRS?
There is a relation. So we do see CRS associated with the neurotoxicity, but we have also seen cases where their CRS has resolved and they develop the neurotoxicity post-CRS. So I think they are independent but related.
But I mean, even the delayed ones, you don't see focal changes, right?
Focal changes meaning?
Focal neurologic issues. It's more like a confusion.
It's a global, right. So there are global effects. I mean, we see seizures. We see generalized seizures. We have seen paralysis in some patients. And again, we don't really have a good understanding of the mechanism of the neurotoxicity. We don't know what the mechanism is. And we've used cetuximab and other IL-6-directed agents to mitigate it, as well as steroids. And my impression has been that the steroids are probably a bit more effective than the IL-6-directed therapies at managing the neurotoxicity. But we don't have a good understanding of the mechanism or really a highly effective management algorithm for the neurotoxicity yet.
Interesting. Any thought that in some way the CNS issues could be immunologic?
So they're probably related to the CAR-Ts because there have been reports of investigators evaluating and measuring CAR-Ts present in the spinal fluid. So that is probably immunologic, and it probably the mechanism is through the CAR-T, but how the CAR-T causes the neurotoxicity that we see and what's the mechanism of those manifestations, I think, is really very, very poorly understood. The cerebral edema, also the mechanism of cerebral edema, is probably a cytokine effect, but that's the most severe form of the neurotoxicity that's been seen. And again, the mechanism for that is still not well understood.
That's interesting. Actual cerebral edema, like on the entire brain?
Correct. The entire brain swells and patients have herniated.
Wow.
Because of increased intracranial pressure.
Huh. What's been seen at autopsy when the patients die? I've seen there's some deaths.
So there's very limited data, and I don't think that that has been reported yet in terms of autopsy in these neurotoxicity, in these cerebral edema cases.
I next met with Dr. Amit Lahoti, a nephrologist from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and to begin, he provided his perspective on tumor lysis syndrome.
The main point that I would want to drive home to medical oncologists or supportive care physicians is that tumor lysis syndrome appears to be occurring perhaps even more frequently with the advances in targeted therapy, immunotherapies, with CAR T cells. We're seeing much more effective therapy for tumors that previously we would never see tumor lysis syndrome. So, you know, obviously your acute leukemias, your Burkitt's lymphomas, we know that these patients are at high risk of lysis, but I think oncologists need to be aware now with the advances in therapy that even tumors that previously like CLL or myeloma that were not previously considered high risk, you still have to be mindful for this complication.
So, you know, it's interesting you mentioned CAR-T because we just did a day-long program on CAR-T. Obviously, it's a big topic. And, you know, you hear about these dramatic, huge drops in tumor volume that these people get. Yet when I've asked the CAR-T people, I don't hear much about it. I mean, obviously there's the cytokine release syndrome that's a great concern. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how easy it is to separate out tumor lysis syndrome in somebody who's going through a cytokine release. But have you seen patients with tumor lysis from CAR-T?
Not frequently. I think we're still kind of on the cusp of the clinical introduction of CAR T cell therapy. And I think as they refine the techniques and find more indications for its use, I would not be surprised if we start seeing it, especially because it's going to be used often in patients who have failed frontline therapy or are advancing to third line therapy or fourth line therapy. So they have very high tumor burden to begin with. These are patients who are already at very high risk. And it's not just going to be liquid tumor patients. I think even solid tumor patients, where you previously see case reports of tumor lysis, now we're seeing case series or much more higher frequency of lysis in this population as well. So I think we're going to see more of it with CAR T cell therapy as well.
Can you talk a little bit about how you envision the pathophysiology of tumor lysis syndrome?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, anytime you have a highly proliferative tumor or very high tumor burden, which is very sensitive to the therapy, the anti-cancer therapy, whether it's conventional chemo or targeted therapy, immunotherapy, you're going to break up these tumor cells fairly rapidly and release the intracellular contents into the bloodstream, specifically potassium, phosphorus, uric acid, and, you know, with the rise in phosphorus, the drop in the serum calcium. And this wreaks havoc on the cardiac rhythms. So you can get arrhythmias, you can get seizures, you can get deposition of uric acid and calcium phosphate crystals in the kidneys, and that can lead to probably the most common complication was acute kidney injury, what used to be called acute renal failure, we call acute kidney injury now. And so if the kidneys are still functioning fine, you have normal kidney function, and they're able to keep up with the excretion of these products, that's great. The problem really comes in when the production release of these substances outpaces the excretion or elimination. And that's where you start getting into problems.
So I have to ask you, you mentioned the terminology acute kidney injury. What's behind that change in terminology?
This evolved around 10 years ago. There was different nomenclature, different definitions of how do you define acute renal failure. And so failure connotes complete loss of function, which is why they went to injury, acute kidney injury. And you know what they defined is as little as a change or rise of 0.3 in the serum creatinine connotes acute kidney injury. That is stage one acute kidney injury. And that or a 50% rise in the creatinine. So if you have a baseline of 0.8 and it goes to 1.2, that is acute kidney injury. I think these are subtle early changes that previously were not recognized as acute kidney injury. And if you look at all the studies, there's been hundreds of studies now looking at this new classification, and this correlates. Even these early small changes in creatinine correlate with increased mortality, increased length of stay, increased costs, et cetera. So
that's really interesting about, you know, as little as 0.3. I mean, how much variation do you see just in laboratory measurement?
That's a good point. And there are obviously other factors that affect your serum creatinine level, your hydration status, concomitant medications which affect creatinine excretion or secretion into the urine. Your diet can also affect it as well. So unfortunately, creatinine is not a perfect marker of renal function, right? You have to lose a significant amount of kidney function before you start to see a rise in the serum creatinine. Unfortunately, it's the best marker that we have currently.
So, you know, one of the issues, obviously, when you look at the issue of risk for TLS, renal function is a very important issue. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about renal function with age and other, you mentioned medications. What are the major things you look at when you just clinically are going to assess renal function?
Yeah, so I think almost universally, most hospitals have adopted what's called the estimated GFR. That's where you take in the creatinine, the age, the gender, the race, ethnicity of the patient, and it goes into a logarithmic equation, which has been validated in many populations. Previously, we used what was called the Cockcroft-Gault. Now it's been replaced with what's called the MDRD equation. And this gives you a nice estimate of what is the GFR, glomerular filtration rate. How well are the kidneys filtering the blood? And so what you'll find is creatinines of 1 in a 20-year-old may be perfectly fine, but a creatinine of 1 in a 80-year-old frail cachectic individual may signify a GFR of 50 or 60. And so the GFR is a much better reflection of kidney function as opposed to the absolute serum creatinine level alone. So especially in the elderly or the cachectic in our cancer patients who are emaciated, you really have to look at the MDRD or the estimated GFR as opposed to an absolute creatinine level. That can be very misleading. Oftentimes, the serum creatinine may be quote-unquote normal. But if you were actually measure the true GFR with a nuclear medicine scan or iothalamic clearance or a formal study, you'll find that most of these patients will have at least stage 3 chronic kidney disease. So it's not unusual for these patients if they were to get a contrast study and their creatinine appears normal and they develop renal failure or acute kidney injury afterwards and everyone's surprised. Well, the creatinine was essentially normal at the beginning. Well, the true GFR really was not normal. It just appeared that way in this older patient who probably has low muscle mass to begin with.
Clinically, what's a typical GFR for a 30-year-old, a 60-year-old, and a 90-year-old?
Yeah, so in the 20 to 30-year-old, you'll find the normal GFR is probably somewhere around 100 to 120 milliliters per minute per meter squared. If you were to look at the older population, the 60, 70, 80-year-old, it's probably drops on the average probably somewhere around 60 to 70. That includes all comers, not just patients with cancer.
Why don't we go through these cases and you can talk about, you know, kind of from a teaching point of view, what the key point is here, beginning with your 46-year-old man.
Sure. So, you know, the first case, a 46-year-old man, history of metastatic melanoma, widely metastatic, mets to the brain, lungs, liver, lymph nodes, kidneys, peritoneum, received nab-paclitaxel. Subsequently thereafter, his lab studies revealed a uric acid level of 18.4, potassium of 6.4, and a phosphorus of 12.6. Subsequently, the patient received rasburicase, but unfortunately had progressive oliguria, worsening renal function, and was started on dialysis. Again, a solid tumor patient, high disease burden, high tumor burden, and develops full-blown tumor lysis syndrome.
Did this patient have a response to the chemotherapy?
It would appear they did, given the fact that they had tumor lysis syndrome. Unfortunately, his disease burden was so high that with the development of complications such as the need for dialysis, he subsequently developed pulmonary infiltrates and worsening respiratory distress and basically went into multi-organ failure shortly thereafter. So he never was able to fully recover from this episode of tumor lysis syndrome.
He died?
He did.
And any thoughts about why he would have this profound tumor lysis syndrome? I mean, yeah, you mentioned the tumor burden, but you know, lots of people have that kind of tumor burden. Any reason why he specifically, do you think, had this serious problem?
Yeah, so, and what I didn't mention is he also had underlying chronic kidney disease. So I think that's why he was so sensitive to the therapy that he received. His creatinine already baseline was in the threes. So his GFR already was less than 30 or 40 at that time. So any little tumor lysis that he had manifested in full-blown tumor lysis syndrome. And that's really one of the lessons here in that patients with chronic kidney disease are certainly much more susceptible to tumor lysis syndrome.
I see he did have a tumor involvement in the kidneys. What was the reason that you're thinking about why he had this chronic renal failure?
He had previous therapies and multiple lines of chemotherapy, targeted therapy. He also received immunotherapy, and we actually ended up doing a renal biopsy of his kidney to see if he developed a nephritis from the immunotherapy. What it turned out actually is very interesting. He actually had widespread melanoma within the glomerular capillaries and in the interstitium. So there was no adverse effect from the immunotherapy. This was just progressive melanoma in his kidneys.
That's fascinating. You mentioned immunotherapy, and obviously with the checkpoint inhibitors, and you know, you have the king of checkpoint inhibitors at MD Anderson there.
Jim Allison, right?
Jim Allison. But obviously we've seen a spectrum of autoimmune disorders, pneumonitis, colitis, etc. Have immune glomerulonephritides been seen with checkpoint inhibitors?
It has. It's not commonly reported, and it's not as common as you would see with colitis or hepatitis or thyroiditis or pneumonitis. But we certainly had several biopsies. We've collected probably about 8 or 9 so far recently of nephritis from checkpoint inhibitors.
Do these patients have proteinuria also?
Not commonly significant proteinuria, because this really isn't a glomerular nephritis. This is more of an interstitial nephritis.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh.
Yeah, so they're not spilling a lot of albumin into the urine typically, and it's oftentimes a very bland urinary sediment.
So if you have a patient on a checkpoint inhibitor, how do you know that this is occurring?
Yeah, sometimes it's very difficult to tell just from the urine sediment alone. It's the clinical suspicion, the temporal relationship of the worsening renal function with the therapy, which makes you suspicious.
So this unfortunate man obviously had a sky-high uric acid, got raspy uricase. Can you talk a little bit about the physiology of uric acid and the agents we have that are used to try to control it?
Sure. So purine metabolism, basically. So when you have high cell turnover and you're breaking down proteins, they're broken down into hypoxanthine, which is converted into xanthine, and subsequently by xanthine oxidase into uric acid. Okay, and that's done in the liver. And so what happens here is when you have lysis of cells, this whole process is ramped up, and then you get rapid production of uric acid at that point, which is fine if the kidney functions normal and can excrete the uric acid. But unfortunately, oftentimes it outpaces elimination, and that's where you get uric acid deposition and crystals depositing within the kidneys. You can get vasoconstriction from hyperuricemia. You can also get endothelial dysfunction with decreased nitric oxide and upregulation of renin-angiotensin aldosterone. So all that wreaks havoc on the kidneys specifically. And so the therapies that we have currently for this are allopurinol, which inhibits xanthine oxidase. So you block the conversion of hypoxanthine to xanthine or the conversion of xanthine to uric acid, which is great because it will prevent the formation of new uric acid. However, it does not break down already elevated uric acid. So if you're already hyperuricemic, treatment with allopurinol will not rapidly lower the level. It'll just prevent the formation of new uric acid. And so over the past 10 to 15 years, in the advent of rasburicase, initially in the pediatric population, then rolled out into the adult population, which is urate oxidase. Okay, and this is a recombinant form. Now, non-recombinant urate oxidase has been around for quite some time, which is derived from aspergillus. But unfortunately, there's a high degree of immunogenicity with a non-recombinant form. So the recombinant purified form has been developed, and this rapidly breaks down already formed uric acid. So if you're hyperuricemic, it's a very nice option to use to bring down uric acid levels quite rapidly.
What do you typically see in a patient you give RASP uricase to? How is it administered? And how often is it usually used, just once, or do you have to sometimes use it more than once?
Yeah, the manufacturer recommendations and the FDA approval or the recommendations suggest weight-based dosing, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram per day for 5 days. In Europe, it can be used up to 7 days as determined by the physician. But so in the United States, for 5 days. So if you take a 70 kilogram person or patient, they're getting upwards of 10 to 14 milligrams per day for 5 days. That's quite a bit of drug. And this is a, you know, obviously a fairly new therapy. It's a very expensive therapy. It's probably one of the more expensive supportive care drugs that we have in the oncology realm. And so since then, there have been numerous studies looking at fixed dosing, just one-time dose. And this can range anywhere from 3 milligrams up to 7.5 milligrams. And what's been shown is that the most recent I'll cite is a study in 2013, a meta-analysis of about 10 studies. Again, only two of these were prospective. It was about 250 or 260 patients total. And what they compared was the product label dosing of RASP uricase versus one-time fixed dosing versus allopurinol. And what they found was that RASP uricase, no matter how you dosed it, was much more effective than allopurinol in decreasing serum uric acid levels. So that's no big surprise. I think what was interesting, though, in this meta-analysis is that even 6 milligrams or 7.5 milligrams one-time dose was just as effective in lowering uric acid levels compared to weight-based dosing for 5 days. So this has got significant economic implications, right? This is an expensive drug. If a 5-day course can run anywhere from $30,000 to $40,000. If you're doing a fixed dose, anywhere from 3 to 7.5 milligrams, it would cost you somewhere between $2,000 to $4,500. And if you multiply that by the number of patients that actually get this drug in a year, that is a significant cost savings. And more importantly, less chance of adverse effects on the patient. You can get hypersensitivity to the drug with repeat dosing. Patients who have G6PD deficiency, you cannot use the drug, and so they're at risk of getting methemoglobinemia and hemolytic anemia. So it's safer for the patient, it's significantly in cost savings. And so what we do at our institution now is we have strict guidelines that we can only use this in patients who have high risk of lysis, and we give a fixed 3 milligram dose, which can be repeated based on serial lab testing.
So how long do you wait before you decide whether to repeat it?
We do it the next day or the day after. Yeah, the onset of action is fairly quick with this drug. Within 4 hours, you'll start to see a decline in uric acid. The half-life's anywhere from 17 to 21 hours. So you will see a rapid, durable response with one-time dose of RASP uricase. But in severe cases, you may have to repeat it, and it's been reported upwards of 20% of patients may require a repeat dose.
What about tolerability issues with the RASP uricase? You mentioned reactions. What kind of reactions do you see? Any other side effects?
Yeah, so it's pretty well tolerated for the most part. Headaches, some GI, mild GI discomfort sometimes with the drug. But the more important issues really are hypersensitivity reactions, as well as patients who have G6PD deficiency. Because as with any drug that's an oxidizing agent, it converts ferrous to ferric, or iron. It converts it from the ferrous state to the ferric state, and therefore heme is less able to bind to oxygen. Patients become hypoxic, cyanotic. It can lead to a hemolytic anemia at that point.
What about the issue of actual measurement of uric acid in patients who received RASP uricase? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and so that's certainly an issue, because when you draw the blood, the RASP uricase is still active in the test tube. So what's recommended is that the test tube is placed on ice and it's taken to the lab fairly quickly and for analysis done fairly quickly as well. Otherwise, you will get falsely low levels of uric acid in the blood.
So let's go through a couple other potential issues with tumor lysis syndrome in addition to uric acid. Maybe you can talk about potassium.
Sure. So potassium obviously is a big issue when you have tumor lysis. It leads to cardiac dysrhythmias, which is the most dreaded complication of high potassium. And unfortunately, patients who have chronic kidney disease at baseline are much more susceptible to this. This is where we really need to keep up the urine flow. So it's very important in tumor lysis to have a urine output of at least 100 milliliters per hour is what's recommended. So you generally, with isotonic saline, the more flow you have going through the kidney, the more potassium you can excrete. So that's very important to maintain urinary flow. The problems occur when patients start getting oliguric, worsening renal function. That's when you may need the nephrologist to institute some kind of renal replacement therapy or dialysis at that point.
So getting back to your melanoma patient, I see he had a potassium at one point of 6.4. Did he have any clinical consequences?
So he did not have any clinical consequences at that time. Dialysis was started fairly rapidly with improvement in his electrolytes. He did get rasburicase, uric acid did come down, but unfortunately his kidneys never really recovered and he developed multi-organ failure thereafter, yeah.
Any other supportive maneuvers you have to use for hyperkalemia, insulin?
No, sure, yeah. The most important thing is to protect the heart, stabilize the membrane. So you want to give calcium gluconate, 1 to 2 grams IV push, and that'll help to prevent any cardiac dysrhythmias until you're able to institute more definitive therapy to get the potassium down, whether that's going to be with a potassium binding resin. Traditionally, we've always used sodium polystyrene sulfate, SPS. There are some newer resins that are out on the market now, which have been shown to be much more efficacious in lowering potassium, but they're not approved for the acute setting. It's more in patients who have advanced chronic kidney disease and have mild hyperkalemia. But I wouldn't be surprised if those translate into the acute setting as well. Other temporizing measures that you can do are insulin with glucose to help push the potassium intracellular and lower extracellular levels as well.
How about phosphate and calcium?
Sure. So phosphorus, the main route of elimination of phosphorus is the kidney. So unfortunately, if you have worsening kidney function, phosphorus will rapidly accumulate. And as the serum phosphorus rises, it binds to calcium and calcium will drop. And so one of the hallmarks of diagnosis of laboratory tumor lysis syndrome is a calcium level less than 7. And this is a problem because your cardiac rhythm is not only dependent on your potassium level, but also the balance with calcium as well. So hypocalcemia can lead to muscle cramps, it could lead to tetany, but more importantly, it could also lead to cardiac dysrhythmias as well. We don't normally replace the calcium in these situations unless it does drop very low, though I must confess, because when you raise the calcium and you already have high phosphorus levels, you're more predisposed to having calcium phosphate deposition, what we call metastatic calcification. It can deposit in the vessels and the soft tissues, and most importantly in the kidneys, and cause worsening renal function.
Do you see a clinical sequela of hypocalcemia, tetany?
We don't quite often see it, quite honestly. Generally by that point, the patient would have started some kind of therapy for the tumor lysis or the hyperphosphatemia. And generally that's going to involve dialysis at that point. Usually if the phosphorus is that high and the calcium has dropped that low, we've already started some kind of therapy to bring the phosphorus down.
Let's hear a little bit about your 74-year-old man. I'm really curious about this patient. Because, of course, we now, talking about tumor lysis syndrome, we have on the table venetoclax. This is a man who had CLL since 2010, multiple lines of systemic treatment, chemotherapy, poor prognostic features, who got ibrutinib and venetoclax, a combination, I guess, on a phase 2 clinical trial. It looks like the patient started out with a white count of 275,000. It dropped to 165,000 before the venetoclax was started. This patient actually got rasburicase, I guess because of the high risk situation, and actually it looked like ended up doing pretty well.
Did well. Yeah, it's very interesting. When venetoclax came out, or previously, it was referred to as ABT-199.
Right.
I still remember the oncologist being very concerned about tumor lysis because early studies did reveal this, what they called a hyper tumor lysis syndrome. And so they would call us even before the patient received the drug. Hey, look, we're going to give this drug. We want you on board because we really are concerned that this patient's going to develop TLS. And so I think with experience in the trials, they've really optimized how they give venetoclax at this point. And typically, we'll bring the Y count down for a few cycles with some type of targeted therapy. In this case, he received ibrutinib for a few cycles, bringing the Y count down. And then when they instituted venetoclax, that they gave judicious hydration and they gave ribosomal as prophylaxis. And so this is interesting because CLL historically is not a tumor type that we were concerned about. We never saw tumor lysis with CLL, or rarely saw tumor lysis. And so now with this powerful targeted therapy that we have, this has now fallen into the high risk category.
It's interesting though, you know, I guess there's something about BCL2 and CLL that's, you know, that pathway is upregulated because we're hearing now about venetoclax in mantle cell lymphoma, multiple myeloma, AML, and it doesn't seem like you see tumor lysis. It seems like this is something related to CLL specifically.
Yeah, I don't know if in CLL it's just much more effective or they're just much more sensitive to the BCL2 inhibition. That's an interesting point. You're right. I have not seen it as commonly in other tumor types.
So it's interesting that this patient got ribosomal preemptively, because if you look at the venetoclax package insert, they have this whole table about what you do and when you hospitalize people. But I don't see anything there. Maybe it's because he was on a clinical trial. But how do you decide when to bring ribosomal in a patient getting venetoclax?
Right. So at least in this particular trial, it is routinely done for these patients. If they're going to get this drug, they are going to get ribosomal prophylaxis. And so I think it's fallen into this category of high risk. So when we're talking about prophylaxis, you can talk about low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk. And low and intermediate risk typically would just be fluids. You may use allopurinol. It's the high-risk patients that you really worry about, the AMLs, the ALLs, the Burkitt lymphomas. And now you could classify CLL in patients who are receiving BCL2 inhibition into that category that ribosomal prophylaxis is indicated.
So I guess in terms of being high-risk, from what I can tell, it sounds like there are two issues. One is the amount of tumor. So reflected by the white count, in this case, it's 165,000, the size of lymph nodes, but also renal function. So are those the two main determinants?
Those would be the main determinants along with your serum LDH level. You know, if you have bulky nodal disease, those would primarily be your main determinants. You know, clearly patients who have chronic kidney disease as well, as we've discussed, are at higher risk of developing TLS.
So let's go on and talk about some of your other cases. Maybe you can talk about your other 74-year-old man.
Okay, so it's a 74-year-old man with a history of CML transformed to AML, status post-chemotherapy with Hydra and cladribine and LDAC. Patient received allopurinol, 300 milligrams daily as prophylaxis for tumor lysis, starting 3 days prior to chemotherapy. The white count was 8.2 with 40% blast on the peripheral smear. 3 days later, labs were checked and the white count was 0.6 with 10% blast. Potassium was 6.5. The calcium was low at 6. The phosphorus 12.7 and a uric acid was only 4.3. However, the creatinine increased from 1.1 to 2.3 with decreased urine output and the patient was started on dialysis. So this is a nice example of a patient who, despite adequate control of the serum uric acid, still developed a complication of acute kidney injury, presumably from tumor lysis syndrome and likely calcium phosphorus deposition in the kidneys.
What was done in addition to dialysis to manage him? I see also his calcium was down and phosphorus was up.
Yeah, so once he started on dialysis, the phosphorus came down nicely and the calcium came up appropriately. So nothing specifically was done with that. Obviously, the potassium was fixed with dialysis as well. There may have been also some uric acid deposition in the kidneys as well. It was just so rapid that we didn't see a rise in the serum levels, which may have also contributed. Unfortunately, this patient's hospital course, he continued to decline and also went into multi-organ failure and passed away shortly thereafter.
We were talking about myeloma. Let's hear about your 60-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is a 60-year-old man with a history of advanced multiple myeloma complicated by end-stage renal disease secondary to multiple myeloma. He received chemotherapy with carfilzomib, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone. The white count was 2.4 with 12% circulating plasma cells in the peripheral blood smear. His last bone marrow revealed 80% lambda monotypic plasma cells. The patient was started on allopurinol prophylaxis. 3 days later, potassium was 6.1, a phosphorus at 10.2, and a uric acid at 12.5. His frequency of dialysis was increased in order to give him more metabolic clearance and to fix his electrolyte abnormalities. And so again, this is a case of a tumor type that typically is not associated with tumor lysis syndrome, multiple myeloma, it classifies into the low risk. But you always have to keep it in mind in patients who have very advanced disease, who have circulating blasts on the peripheral smear, they're at high risk of developing TLS, or much more rarely, plasma cell leukemia, obviously are at risk of TLS as well.
So what was his renal function like before he got treatment?
So this patient already was on dialysis to begin with. So we weren't as concerned of worsening renal function, obviously. The kidneys were already gone. I think our main concern was calcium phosphate deposition throughout the body and cardiac dysrhythmias from the hyperkalemia and the hypocalcemia.
I'm curious, not so much related to this patient, but maybe more for the patient presenting with renal failure, or I guess I should say renal injury in any event, maybe renal failure. But we've heard the last few years, and actually there was a study reported in the American Society of Hematology last December on the uses of a special dialysis membrane in patients with myeloma. This is amazing. This is actually, I think, a randomized study. Can you talk a little bit about that device and whether or not it's being utilized in the United States?
Yeah, so that was a very exciting therapy that really grabbed hold of the nephrology community's attention because we really didn't have a good extracorporeal treatment of circulating light chains or free light chains. You know, we always just depended on effective chemotherapy. And so what this is a special type of filter on a dialysis machine, which actually clears light chains much more effectively than, say, plasmapheresis does. With one session, you can clear 80 to 90% of free light chains that are circulating in the blood. So this is very exciting. They recently completed two multi-center European trials looking at this therapy in the setting of biopsy-proven CAS nephropathy. And what they found was that there was no significant benefit of this therapy when you looked at it in a randomized trial. You know, prior to this, there were several case series looking at high cutoff filters, which is what they're called. But unfortunately, when it was put into the multicenter trials, which were just reported earlier this year, late last year, they found that there really wasn't a significant benefit in high cutoff filters with the advent of novel targeted therapy. I think what's really changed this, the presumed efficacy of this therapy, is bortezomib. And when you have myeloma and you have kidney involvement, and bortezomib has really revolutionized the way we treat these patients. Because not only are you getting NF-kappa-B inhibition in the myeloma cells, there's upregulation of NF-kappa-B in the kidneys as well, which generally leads to tubular injury and ATN and fibrosis. So you're inhibiting NF-kappa-B in the kidneys as well. It almost has a renal protective effect independent of treating the myeloma. So perhaps with this novel effective chemotherapy that we're targeted therapy that we have, high cutoff filters have not been shown to be as effective as we thought they were 10 years ago when they first came out.
Why don't we talk about your 30-year-old man with CML?
Sure. So a 30-year-old man, 1 year history of CML on and off therapy with dasatinib secondary to insurance reasons. He initially presented 1 year prior with a white count of 363,000 and LDH level of 20,000. Treatment at that time when he initially presented was complicated by tumor lysis syndrome. He now currently presents to the emergency center off his medicines with easy bruising and fatigue, and he was found to have a white count of 455,000 with 2% blasts on the peripheral smear. The creatinine was 1.4 in presentation, but his electrolytes were normal. The uric acid was mildly elevated at 8.4. The patient was started an allopurinol prophylaxis and was given one dose of rasburicase. He subsequently resumed his dasatinib. He underwent leukapheresis and had a decrease of his white count to 84.7 on discharge. His potassium had peaked at 5.4 and the phosphorus peaked at 5.6, but his renal function remained improved and remained normal throughout the rest of his hospital stay.
So what is the teaching point behind this case?
Not all hyperleukocytosis is at risk of tumor lysis syndrome, and you don't need to be incredibly aggressive with rasburicase per se in these cases, especially with leukapheresis when you can gradually bring down the white count, you can institute, you know, definitive targeted therapy to get a sustained decrease in the white count. This patient actually did quite well, and at follow-up, the white count was down to less than 10, and the renal function, the creatinine remained at 0.8. So not all tumor types are at risk of developing tumor lysis syndrome, despite a white count of 450,000.
So I want to take a step back and ask you about some of the common issues you see seeing cancer patients as a nephrologist that you might want to comment on, particularly maybe things you see oncologists doing that are maybe they could be doing better, myths or misperception, and maybe talk a little bit about the spectrum of renal issues in the cancer patient.
Yeah, sure. I think one of my pet peeves is elevated uric acid levels being treated when they don't necessarily need to be treated, meaning it's not tumor lysis syndrome, and the patient may be somewhat pre-renal or volume depleted, which also causes hyperuricemia. Oftentimes, patients are put on a thiazide diuretic or some kind of diuretic, and you'll see a rise in the uric acid level. That is physiologically appropriate. That's not going to cause them to have, you know, kidney stones or worsening renal function. And so the reflex, I think, oftentimes is to start allopurinol or, you know, some kind of uricosuric agent when the patient really doesn't need it. And these drugs, they do have side effects. They can have GI side effects, and they can have hypersensitivity skin reactions with allopurinol. They have drug interactions with other drugs. So that's something not all hyperuricemia needs to be treated, especially if it's mild.
Can you talk about kind of what level provokes what action?
I would say if anything is less than 10 and the patient has a reason to be hyperuricemic, either they're volume depleted or they're on diuretics, I would not reflexively start allopurinol or any other drugs, febuxostat, to lower the serum uric acid levels. I think you have to look at the whole clinical picture because there's nothing that states that asymptomatic hyperuricemia needs to be treated.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special CME program on tumor lysis syndrome.